All right, members, public, I know we want to have fun and we want to talk a lot because we are pre-gaming our birthdays. Rick Hansen and I are, Representative Hansen and I are. But we also have important things in front of this committee as well, not just our upcoming birthdays. So today I call the meeting of the Capital Investment Committee, February 27th, that's today, to order. And we do have a quorum, so that is exciting. Let's see here. Representative Hansen, would you give me a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, while I'm still young, I will move the minutes for February 25th.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen moves approval of the minutes for February 25th. Any discussion? All right, hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Fantastic, all those opposed? I love it, minutes are approved. And we have three short presentations today by state agencies on the governor's bonding projects. I know you're waiting in anticipation on that. Up we have, I believe, the Department of Administration. Fantastic, welcome to the Capital Investment Committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, members. I'm Tamar Grunval. I'm the Commissioner at the Department of Administration, and with me today is Assistant Commissioner Wayne Wazlowski. It's really good to be with all of you today, and great to see many of you again. I'm mindful that this committee has a very full agenda today, and I will be succinct in my presentation. Thank you for your continued support of admin's important work across the entire state and work that's in many, many Minnesota communities. I'm happy to share the details of admin's capital budget requests. And as I mentioned, I brought Assistant Commissioner Wayne Wazlowski with me, and we're ready to answer your questions. In our time together, I'll do two things. First, I'll review at a very high level the state's deferred maintenance and asset preservation, and then I'll provide an overview of the governor's budget requests. As I mentioned, I want to thank all of you for your continued support of our work. I'll start by highlighting admin's work that is relevant to the Capital Investment Committee. Admin's primary role is to help government best serve Minnesotans. We are a central service agency with a wide-ranging set of responsibilities that ultimately touches every part of state government. We do that through cost-effective and transparent services that make government more accessible and responsible to the public. We carry out that work in part by managing, constructing, and leasing property for state government. Team members in the Facilities Management Division are the ones who respond when a light bulb is out or when you need your office painted. They also maintain and operate admin's 23 state-owned buildings, including the state capitol, plus parking facilities, monuments, and grounds. When money is appropriated to agencies for construction projects, our Real Estate and Construction Services Division manages that work. These projects include planned bonding projects and unanticipated emergency repair work, which I'll talk a little bit more about today. The division also provides comprehensive leasing services to state agencies. They negotiate and manage 650 property leases annually, including state-operated group homes throughout Minnesota. The Enterprise Real Property Division coordinates property data for 19 state agencies. The division utilizes this information to help determine state asset preservation funding needs and the fiscal impact of deferring facility maintenance. The Office of Enterprise Sustainability works with cabinet-level agencies to streamline their operations and bolster their resiliency. They help agencies reduce their energy and water usage and diminish their waste. The office also partners with our fleet and procurement divisions to integrate sustainability measures into all state services. To help illustrate the critical need to fund agency asset preservation requests, please consider the following information on the state's deferred maintenance. Minnesota owns over 4,800 buildings spread across 19 state agencies and across all Minnesota communities. This adds up to more than 34 million square feet. These buildings have a replacement value of over $11.2 billion. The average age of these buildings is 43 years of age, with 45% of them over the age of 40. In addition to regular maintenance at that age, many building mechanical systems will need significant upgrades or complete replacement. Admin has calculated that the deferred maintenance on these buildings to be an estimated $2.2 billion. I want to highlight the importance of asset preservation and taking care of what we have. The governor continues to recommend a significant portion of his bonding bill go to fund state agency asset preservation projects. Asset preservation has become an increasingly important challenge for state agency operations. Adequately maintaining state facilities is imperative to support the efficient and effective delivery of services and programs to our customers and the people of Minnesota, again, through all of our communities. Asset preservation funding improves safety and better government while protecting state investments in the following ways. First, funding asset preservation and maintaining property stewardship ensures that staff, the public, and custodial individuals are kept safe and that functional needs are optimally met. Next, timely planned preventative maintenance reduces the total cost of ownership, eventually freeing up resources for core program functions. Next, the cost to maintain a building is cheaper than the cost to repair it. The green line on the graph above highlights the cost per square foot to repair our state-owned buildings, depending on the building condition status. The blue bar graph also reflects the percentage of the percent of state-owned buildings within each building status category. Addressing some of the backlog to remain current on repairs is efficient budgeting because it costs more to fix breaks and respond to urgencies than to fund planned upkeep. Finally, funding asset preservation requests saves energy and reduces greenhouse gases. Modern, properly operating buildings use less energy and water, making agency buildings more operationally efficient while reducing energy costs. Next, I'll move on to the governor's recommendations for admin. First, the governor recommends additional investment to maintain CAPRA, which is an acronym for the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account. CAPRA is the state's rainy day fund and covers emergency repairs and hazardous materials abatement for state agencies. This program ensures that when state agencies experience unanticipated emergencies in their facilities, they are operational again quickly and that construction projects are not delayed if hazardous materials are discovered. Demand for these emergency repair funds has grown due to the increasing age of state facilities and, again, limited funding for preventative maintenance. As I mentioned previously, admin estimates the deferred maintenance backlog to be $2.2 billion for state-owned properties. For example, in the spring of 2024, so last year, CAPRA funds were used to address flood damage on state-owned property, as well as roof, water main, and sewer line replacements. A full listing of the $8 million of emergency repairs from 2024 can be found in the annual CAPRA report. CAPRA funding is a critical operational need. I cannot overemphasize the importance of this funding being included in a bonding bill, no matter its size. Very little CAPRA funds are currently available, and a few weather events or hazardous discoveries could completely deplete the fund this year. This could leave agencies with no choice but to divert operating funds, and as a result, reduce services or programs to resolve building emergencies. Next, the governor recommends providing resources to implement additional safety upgrades recommended by the Advisory Committee on Capital Area Security, also known as ACAS. These upgrades were identified in the 2014 Physical Security Study and the 2022 Assessment Update. The 2014 Physical Security Study was focused on the physical vulnerabilities of the facilities on the Capitol complex, and it was performed by architects, engineers, and security professionals. It examined the structural, landform, and architectural elements of structures. It assigned security level, risk levels, and priorities, and it provided the recommended physical security improvements for the complex. The study was completed in June of 2014 and updated in 2022 to include changes to threats and costs. If the vulnerabilities identified in the original and updated study are not removed, there could be a loss of life, assets, and the impact to government operations. The upgrades have been implemented in phases and as funding becomes available. This photo shows the new turnstiles and security kiosk in the admin building, which were made possible by a portion of the $10 million appropriated in 2018. While this funding has been much appreciated across the Capitol complex, considerable vulnerabilities remain. Over half of the Capitol complex population and building square footage has not received the security upgrades necessary to improve safety and security. So we are asking for resources to make progress to close those gaps. Finally, the governor recommends a budget neutral policy establishing the state building renewable energy storage and electric vehicle account. This would enable admin to leverage federal funds for renewable energy and energy storage upgrades at state-owned facilities. Admin will apply for and accept federal cash rebates on behalf of the state for eligible renewable energy projects and EV fleet purchases. Dollars would be used to help fund future renewable energy projects. In summary, here's an overview of our requests. Thank you for the opportunity to present Admin's capital budget request this morning, and thank you for your support of Admin's work going forward. Our work improves both our communities here in the metro area as well as communities across our entire state. Thank you, and we stand ready for questions.
Thank you for that. Vice Chair Fogelman, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming today. I just gonna try and ask these all quick. I don't know how much you can answer, but any information would be appreciated. I would like to know how many empty buildings that we currently have. How many are empty because people are working from home, and if we know how many people are actually working from home. And do you look at better ways to utilize and maintain what we have?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You have to go through the chair. Thank you. So, Commissioner Grondahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Fogelman. On the complex, we do not have any empty state buildings. The admin is working with state agencies and has been over the last 3 years or 2.5 years to implement the state's facilities strategic plan to help agencies consolidate their office space so that we're making the best use of the space that we have. And if my Assistant Commissioner Wayne Wazlowski would like to add to that, I welcome him to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative, the only thing I would add to that is from an enterprise level, we do track as part of the enterprise real property system any vacant buildings, and you'll often see those are the buildings that are the poorest rated from a facility condition assessment, and agencies have plans for demolition of those buildings in most of those cases. So whether it's Department of Natural Resources or direct care and treatment, that is tracked, and agencies incorporate that into their long-term capital planning on how to address those buildings.
Commissioner, if you could just speak a little louder into the microphone, that would be great. Thank you. Do we have any other? Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for coming. I have a question. So you characterized, you have a chart here where you characterize the condition of the buildings, and was wondering if you can give us an example of what's excellent. You have that it looks like 10%, and then what is a crisis condition, which is 10%. Thank you.
Yep, and then we're going to move on to our next testifier after Representative Carroll. Okay. We're going to move on. So, Commissioner Grondahl, did you want to take that one?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Wolowski.
Representative. So as part of our enterprise real property system, state agencies complete a facility condition assessment, and that's a standardized process across the enterprise, so everyone's using the same standards to complete those assessments. And that's a building system breakdown, so they're looking at the roofing system, the mechanical systems, plumbing systems. So they'll go through and rate each of those systems individually within a building, and then that'll roll up into that overall category. And really it has to do with how long the time frame is before you need to do any work on those systems. So anything between 1 to 3 years, for example, is going to be in that excellent category. Anything that, and then it just goes out as you go farther. So if you have a new roof system, obviously you don't expect to have to do major repairs on that for a significant period of time. So that's where it gets into that excellent category. But we can provide a full, more descriptive breakdown of those categories if that would be helpful.
Brief follow-up,
Representative Carroll.
So I guess I didn't hear the answer I was looking for. I wasn't looking for any particular answer, but so it sounds like you do a component by component as opposed to building in total. Is that correct?
Commissioner Wazlowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. So when they're completing the assessments, and those are done for most facilities on an annual basis, but at the greatest every 2 to 3 years, and when you're doing that assessment, they look at each individual building system
when they're doing that evaluation, and then that rolls up into an overall rating for the building itself.
Thank you. And members, I know you had, there's a few of you that had questions. Feel free to take them offline and speak with the commissioners. Thank you. We do have to move on. Next up, thank you for testifying today, and we do have, I believe, Representative Ryer and Representative Allen had questions to ask.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
Yep. Next up, we will have the DHS Direct Care and Treatment, the Children, Youth, and Family presentation. If you want to come on way, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nancy Freeman. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Direct Care and Treatment under the Department of Human Services. With me.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I am Shayna Morris. I'm the Legislative Director for the Early Childhood Administration at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families.
So the first part of our presentation is directly about direct care and treatment. For those who aren't aware, direct care and treatment operates a highly specialized behavioral health care system that serves people with mental illness, substance abuse disorders, and developmental and intellectual disabilities. Because their conditions are complex and challenging to treat, other health care providers cannot or will not serve these patients. DCT operates the healthcare system with psychiatric hospitals and inpatient mental health treatment facilities, inpatient substance abuse treatment facilities, dental clinics, group homes, vocational sites, and sex offender treatment facilities. In all, DCT delivers these services to over 200 sites statewide. We have a little tech issue I'm hearing.
What's that?
Okay. Chair and members, I'm having just a challenge. My slide deck will not move, and I'm sure it's me.
That's all right. We do have our packets in front of us, too, if you just wanted to continue.
Yeah, it just, sorry. No, I struggled for about 15 minutes to even get my stuff to.
Well, let's move on since you have your. So our first, we're presenting our governor's capital budget recommendation. So our first request is for $11.43 million in bonds to ensure that our state-owned facilities will be functional, safe, and in good repair. DCT owns and maintains 3 million square feet of physical plant for its organizations, which includes our largest campuses in St. Peter, Anoka, Moose Lake, Brainerd, and Wilmer, and then 70-plus group homes throughout Minnesota. This is separate from the lease property that we have, and that's about 750,000 square feet. DCT's facilities are highly secure, heavily constructed, while also trying to be therapeutic environments for our patients. Our replacement value is for all of our assets is over $1 billion. The deferred maintenance from this last round of facility condition assessments, like Commissioner Waslowski mentioned prior, is over $180 million. There will never be an absence of deferred maintenance balance for DCT. In our 10-year strategic plan, we estimate approximately $30 million per year is needed to maintain the most critical aspects of DCT facilities. Projects are prioritized based on the need or the level of deficiency. As you can see in your packet, you have on page 7 would be the list of our asset preservation projects for 2025. As you can see, all of the projects are estimated to have an energy and operating savings component. Total, it is estimated over savings of $500,000 per year. And then the previous appropriations that we received for asset preservation are located on the right-hand side of that packet. On page 12, our second request is $15 million to upgrade and replace the water, sanitary, and storm sewer infrastructure on the St. Peter campus. This will ensure that the state-owned facilities used for DCT services are functional, safe, and in good repair. The present drinking water system and sanitary and storm sewer systems on the lower campus were constructed in the early 1950s and have far exceeded their useful life. In 2018, we contracted with an engineering firm to conduct a water and sewer system analysis. The analysis found several deficiencies and recommended replacement of the water main, sanitary sewer, and storm sewer infrastructure located throughout the entire campus. Without improvement, the probability of system failure is very high. It is imperative to replace this critical infrastructure to ensure the campus can continue to operate 24/7, 365, and serve approximately 1,100 people consisting of patients, clients, and staff. Previous funding in 2023 was $1.05 million, specifically for design of the system. We have completed the design of the system, and we are hoping to get funding this session to be able to go out to bid. And that concludes my part of the presentation.
Thank you.
Do you want to take questions, Madam Chair?
I don't think we have any questions yet at this time. Do we have any other questions? Oh, yep, Representative Perez Vega.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. It states here that, sorry, it's all kind of bundled up in one big package here, that funds are awarded via competitive RFP process. You know, can you elaborate on, like, the competitiveness? Because don't we want to make it more accessible? So, I mean, childcare, I have empathy. I'm on this committee here at the state. I'm grateful that it takes a village, right? But, and it costs money. But we need to make it more accessible. So when you put the word competitive, it kind of, it triggers me a little bit because I want folks to have childcare.
Who would like to take that? All right. So is that Ms. Briones?
Morse.
Okay.
Madam Chair, and if it's okay, I have a couple of slides that we didn't yet cover, and I think maybe I'll try to address your question in the slides for DCYF's portion of this.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm waiting for you to put me through. I would appreciate the slides. There's a lot of information that you gave, and we only have two pages, and I know it's going to take a lot of explanation, so I look forward to that follow-through. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Perez Vega. Myself, I do have a little concern about the grants. You know, there has been a lot of fraud in the child care assistance program. There's news on sketchy providers currently happening with J. Cole's. How do we know that if we were to fund statewide grants, that we aren't going to be putting money into facilities that are stealing from the taxpayers of Minnesota?
Madam Chair and Representative Perez Vega, I apologize for the confusion. Slides 9 and 10 hadn't yet been covered, so we're just jumping ahead a little bit. But the slides that I'm here to cover today would include $2.7 million for the governor's proposal around early childhood facilities. The intent of that funding, of course, is to support family access to early childhood programs in safe facilities. Existing statute defines the parameters at section 142A.46, so it would be funding for that section. Eligible facilities are those owned by the state or a political subdivision. So I think that may address a little bit of your question, Madam Chair, on that front. Though they can be leased lease their facilities to programs such as a Head Start program or licensed child care program. And in fact, that is an opportunity at the local level for communities where a local government has an interest in the economic happenings in their community and the needs of families to maintain that economic viability of a community.
there's partnership that can happen there. Same with school districts. School districts are trying to create positive relationships with families in their communities. They'll be serving those families and children for a long time. And so having those conversations with what the needs are in the space of early childhood and how school districts can support that and partner, for example, with a Head Start program can be really important. The grants are issued through a competitive RFP process. That's a fairly sort of, I think, I'm not a grant expert, but that's a fairly standard approach in state government. And I think what it means is that there's an application process. I know that teams have actively been working to create fewer barriers to applications, make them clearer, easier to complete. But there is still an evaluation process that does take into consideration how to allocate limited resources. And statute does outline some of those priorities. One of the priorities is looking at communities where there's the highest percentage of children living in poverty. So that's part of the competitive process, if you will. The other piece that statute lays out is that each of these projects would be limited to $500,000, but $2 million for a facility if there's more than one program happening in a particular actual building. The other component I'll mention besides the investment proposed in the governor's package would be to lower the local match requirement from 50 to 25%. Again, just trying to make these more accessible. The second slide there just shows the history. Past projects have included many local school districts who are looking to build some space for early childhood programs, classroom space for Head Start or classroom space for their own early learning programs. Most of those projects have been completed in Greater Minnesota. Between 1992 and 2014, there was a total of $23 million invested in the program through general funds and GO bonds. 75 projects were completed with that funding, 57 of which were in Greater Minnesota and 18 in the 7-county metro. The last nugget I have on this one is that the last funding for this program after 2014 was in 2023 at $900,000, and happy to answer any follow-up questions you may have about that.
Thank you, Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I can follow off offline. I appreciate you explaining that. I just know that, you know, in the past 3 years, just going to child care centers and then going into the next session year, and that child center doesn't even exist anymore. And so I just really would appreciate a great, huge amount of help from our state for these centers that, you know, looking at the federal level, I know our Head Starts are very concerned right now, and we got to push the volume up a little bit here at the state. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Do you have more to add to your presentation today? No. All right. Sorry, we jumped the gun on that. I thought when you said, are you ready for questions, I thought you were done. Lead Lee has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And most of more a comment to respond to some of these statements that were made. Really appreciate the work that you guys do for all of us. And, you know, I think, you know, just for all of us here in the committee, that capital investment is quite different from all the other committees where a lot of the work, you know, for this program, these are publicly owned entities, you know, our local counties, cities who are doing this work. And if, to your point, if a facility has to shut down, either the city or the county will have to provide that service, or the entity is responsible to paying back the state. And so just know that, you know, bonding is a little bit different from, you know, some of the traditional other budget areas. And so I think, you know, to the piece about fraud, I think we all care about that. Just know that, you know, for this particular program, it is our local partners at the local level who are receiving these funds and maybe partnering out with other outside entities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lee. All right. Well, seeing no further member questions, thank you for your presentation and your time today in front of the Capital Investment Committee.
All right. Next up, we have Minnesota Housing. And Minnesota Housing committed a little later, I think that's how it went. So their presentation will not be on paper form, but you can just look at the screen for that. Thank you for joining us today. If you will, please state your name for the record, and then you can proceed with your presentation.
Chair, friends and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and I am the commissioner at Minnesota Housing. This is my 7th legislative session in this role. It's a pleasure to be with you today, and apologies for any oops on our part, and happy to get the deck to folks after the hearing today. I am here with Dan Kitzberger, who's my legislative director. Behind us is Amanda Welliver, who you'll also see from our policy team this session, and look forward to continuing to work with those of you that I've met before and meeting those of you that I haven't. Just want to go over some basics about Minnesota housing for those that you are newer. Obviously, I think we all agree that housing is foundational to a full life and a thriving state. So we collaborate with individuals, communities, and partners to create and preserve and finance housing that's affordable. I want to frame this by just giving a quick primer on publicly owned housing in Minnesota. There's about 21,000 units that are home to about 36,000 people statewide. These are owned and operated by local public housing authorities, housing and redevelopment authorities, or community development authorities. They have different terms, but they're all public entities with public ownership of housing. This housing is pretty old. Most of the units are over 40 years old, and the people who are live there include many seniors, many people with disabilities, and strikingly, people with extremely low incomes. Public housing is also home to many children, people who are at risk of homelessness, or people who have recently experienced homelessness. In a sense, this publicly owned housing is housing infrastructure in the state of Minnesota that was initially created by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. But that said, the federal funding has not kept pace with the capital needs in these buildings. Nationally, the backlog of repairs in public housing are estimated to be as much as $70 billion, but the annual appropriation for public housing capital fund is only around $3 billion a year. In Minnesota, the estimate is a capital need between 2020 and 2024 of over $500 million. Minnesota has been unique in terms of using general obligation bonds in order to invest in the preservation of this public housing infrastructure. And a lot of it is because these buildings have really critical conditions and things that impact resident health and safety. The most common improvements that we do are to the elevators, to plumbing, to windows and roofs, fire suppression systems, and around accessibility. And you can see in the green box just a profile of who we serve. The governor's recommendation in the bonding bill is to invest $7 million in the publicly owned housing preservation program. Here's the history of the program. I just want to give you a sense of the size of authorizations in the past, the number of projects we've been able to select, what that represents in terms of units, and how that comes out into kind of a fairly modest per unit investment in things that actually really do very critical repairs in these buildings. In fact, over the course of the last decade, these investments have improved about a quarter of the publicly owned units in the state. I saved 2023 for its own slide because it was a very significant investment compared to previous investments, breaking out $87 million in total resources. And then we also had some of it in general obligation bonds, but some of it was in cash in lieu of bonds. And then there was a specific set aside for the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. We've put this funding out in two rounds. In the first round, we awarded $39.5 million, but we had over $92 million in requests. So just to give you a sense of the total need. And we're currently operating an RFP. It took us a minute to figure out how to modify the program to be able to take advantage that we had cash in lieu of general obligation bonds, because there's some things we could do with cash that we couldn't do with GO bonds. So we now have that round open, and we've received 58 initial responses totaling nearly $103 million when we have about $40 million available, just to give you a sense of the scope. This is really just intended to demonstrate that the demand for these funds has outpaced their availability in every instance. And, I guess when we take a look at these proposals, these are all kind of critical needs proposals. So we're not saying that when we make decisions about which ones we fund and which ones we don't, that they're not all necessary. We really try very hard to rank where are the greatest health and safety needs to make sure that we're getting at those proposals first. We love to show dots on a map. And this map shows you where investments in the Public Housing Preservation Program have gone. And to really help demonstrate that this is a program that meets the needs of greater Minnesota in pretty significant ways, over 70% of the funds and over 50% of the units are in greater Minnesota. I think I'll just let that be at that. Let me take you to Red Wing and Jordan Tower. This is an applicant in 2024. This is a building that's over 50 years old, and most of the original mechanicals were beyond their useful life. So the repairs needed included a leaking flat roof, ventilation replacement, updated plumbing, and exterior doors. Obviously, you know, these are not glamorous updates. This is just really critical infrastructure, and a lot of it isn't even immediately visible. It's stuff that happens down in the boiler room. Give you a sense of the state that the building is in. These are the pipes that are beyond repair. This is water ponding on the roof. This is a shot of the exterior doors that shows how badly they're rusted out. In 2020, we did a round of investments in this property to deal with a backup generator. The old generator only had the capacity to power emergency systems. Right here in St. Paul on Wabasha, we have the Wabasha High Rise. This was a problem where you had bricks on the exterior that were actually deteriorating onto the sidewalk. This is not only an aesthetic issue, but it also means that the outer shell of the building is no longer watertight, which can create other problems. The funding restored the exterior of the building, the photo on the right. Again, here in St. Paul, up on Front Avenue, this is the Front Avenue High Rise. I don't think I've ever seen a boiler that looks like the one on the left. That needed to be replaced. And on the right are the new ultra-high efficiency hydronic boilers that have been able to be put in. The project included updates to plumbing, including bathrooms within the units. This is in Virginia, the Columbia Rochelot Apartments. This is work that the fire marshal did to try to keep the fire alarm and system workable. Using a broom handle and some duct tape and other things. So these before projects, I think, very clearly show, you know, what it is that we need to be able to deal with really fundamental safety issues in these buildings. As a bonus up there, that peeling paint is full of asbestos. So the opportunity to be able to deal with that as well during the preservation project is a bonus. I I talk about the projects, I talk about the guts of these buildings, but, you know, it really is about the health and safety of the residents who live there. So I just want to give you a sense of the dire condition of some of these buildings all around the state to let you know the good work that the Public Housing Preservation Program does. Not all states invest in their publicly owned housing infrastructure. This is one of the things that allows us to use the partnership that we have together in order to preserve this infrastructure all across the state. And once again, you know, if you drive through a small town in greater Minnesota, oftentimes there might be one high rise. And that high rise is likely owned by the local public housing authority. Sometimes it's the only building that they own and operate. But it's absolutely a critical federally assisted housing to keep rents low for folks who make the very least. So with that, be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner Ho. Question from me, as I was looking at that map, I did see quite a few counties in rural Minnesota that had not been touched. Is that because there's no public housing in that area or there was no applicants in those areas?
Chair Franzen, thank you for the question. I could get an overlay of where all public housing is, but we can only fund applications that come in. One of the things that my team has done, and I'm proud of it, and I can take credit for it because it was initiated before I started. But we really worked hard to make the application for this program super simple. Some of these small rural public housing authorities like have one or two staff, and they're busy trying to run the building. And so we have made the application conceptual. You don't have to do a whole bunch of costly technical work in order to apply, because we really want to make sure that even the smallest public housing authorities in the state get access to this critical resource.
Great, thank you, Commissioner. And so every county is communicated with that these funds are available and are encouraged to apply, correct?
Chair Franzen, we do communication during the off cycle all the time, and we offer technical assistance to organizations that want to apply. And we work with Minnesota NARO, the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Organizations, which is the trade association for these entities. I actually spoke at their summer conference to talk about all this. We do everything we can to just make sure that people are aware when funds are available.
Great, thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome, Commissioner. So let's say you have a couple grants come in, and one is from a first-tier suburb with an old housing authority, and they're asking for the same amount of money as a small rural town, asking for the same amount of money in their last grant applications. Which one do you fund? Is the criteria that you fund Greater Minnesota first?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Franzen and Representative Hansen, we look at critical health and safety needs as the first criteria. We try very hard to make sure that we have geographic distribution, but everything depends on from where did we get applications in that round and how bad are the health and safety needs. So, the boiler and the fire suppression system and a workable elevator would maybe come ahead of a project that didn't have that level of health and safety risk.
Great. Thank you. Does that answer your question, Representative Hansen? For now? Okay. Representative Perez-Vega?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here, Commissioner Ho. I'm glad that you had your presentation to showcase the Wabasha high-rise in my district, which is actually a part of the Capital Area Complex. When we talk about these lines that address what the Capital Area Complex is, and as someone who sat on the Housing Committee last year, I always put a smile that we had $1.3 billion go, but I was not jumping for joy because the address of housing needs starts with the lower-income families, lower-income individuals, especially our disabled families. I have a majority of my constituents are renters in my district and come from these low-income housing projects. And I just really want to amplify my support towards going to public housing. I didn't grow up in public housing, but my parents did in New York City under some of the worst conditions that I can imagine. When we talk about third world countries, we're talking about the great cities here that make the United States of America. And so to address whether you're in St. Paul in my district or you're in Red Wing, as we can see in greater Minnesota, we want to care for our families. We want to care for our kids. And housing is a human right. So I just want to encourage members of my committee to really put some little glitter on your hearts when we talk about these conditions. I mean, you've seen that pipe, and you see the conditions of that broom being held upon there. And these are the spaces that you help. These are the agencies that you help. So I just want to commend your work on addressing this and please talk to me how we can be more supportive, because what I see in Wabasha shouldn't be happening, and it should be happening in Red Wing as well.
Thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. We have Lead Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. So just real quickly on the 2023 funding piece, I saw that you did two rounds, and then you may have answered this already, but just wanted to double check. So why was there two rounds? Did you mention that because of the cash infusion, you have to run the RFP differently? And then just explaining that, and then just the piece around how much in the first round was unfunded in project costs. Thank you.
Who would like to take that question? Commissioner?
Chair and Representative Lee, I'll always take the first pass, and then Dan can always clean up after me
Certainly.
If I misstate. The
getting cash in lieu of GO bonds expanded what could be eligible and what it could be used for. So the general obligation bonds cannot be used in HUD-constructed property owned by a public housing authority that's gone through something called the HUD Rental Assistance Demonstration. The HUD Rental Assistance Demonstration was a way to make private capital available to public housing authorities in order to make capital investments in programs. But to access that private capital, the buildings are set up under limited liability corporations that don't meet the rules around public ownership of general obligation bonds, even though structurally these LLCs are dotted or straight line relationships to the public housing authority boards that own them. So we can use the cash to be able to invest in buildings that have been taken out of the traditional public housing portfolio and moved into this other classification by HUD that you really don't need to know too much about. It's called RAD, the Rental Assistance Demonstration, but it was really around HUD trying to make private capital available into public buildings. There are also a couple specific uses, which I don't feel ready to talk about today, and Dan may not feel ready to talk about today, but we can get back to you about the specific uses that, because it's cash and not GO bonds, that the funds can be used for.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Ho. We are not ready for that explanation yet either due to time. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a quick follow-up. Really appreciate that. And so just wanted to be clear then that, you know, even though there's $40 million for round two, with the anticipation of at least $103 million that you have received so far, there will be projects that won't be funded if we don't have any further appropriations going forward. Is that correct?
I think I know the answer, Commissioner Ho, but I'll let you answer that.
Chair and Representative Lee, correct. There's projects that will not be funded with the available funds. There's much more need out there than we have funds available.
Great. Thank you. And then we have Representative Zhang and then Scraba. And then we are going to move on to member bills. Representative Zhang, you're good? You yield your time to Representative Scraba. That is a mistake. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Jay. Appreciate that. I was going to ask a question about this screen specifically. When you were explaining it, what I heard may not be what you said, if I may. I looked at the $87 million for the metro area and the $79 million for the greater Minnesota. Yeah, I know. That's why I wanted to ask the question. That's what I heard you say, you know, we have separate money for the metro and for the other. And I was like, what? Did I hear that right? And I did not hear it right because I saw the way you looked at me like, what'd you hear? So could you correct me? What does that screen mean? That's what I don't know if I just looked at it and I saw Minneapolis and I heard, oh, that's great. They got, and kind of answering Representative Hansen's question was, you know, who would you pick? Well, he got two pots of money to choose from. He got 87 in the metro and 78 in the greater, but that's not what it was, correct?
Commissioner Hull.
Chair Friends and Representative Scraba, I point you to slide 9. If you take a look at the history of fundings,
right.
70% of the funds and 50% of the units have been in greater Minnesota. When you take a look at the outcome of the 2023 legislative session, the total in resources that were authorized was $87 million. It included $45.1 million of cash. Okay. $5 million of which was carved out as legislatively named to the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority, and then $41.9 million in general obligation bonds. The general obligation bonds were a part of the round one RFP, and the reason that it doesn't 39.5 awarded doesn't match 41.9 exactly is that sometimes projects cost more by the time they're ready to close, and so there's some margin held there for that discrepancy. And then we've got the cash minus the $5 million that went to MPHA that's in the round two RFP. So the RFPs are not geographically carved out. They're available statewide.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you.
All right. thank you so much for testifying today. And members, if you have other questions, you can email or take them offline, I'm sure.
Do you have a sign-in sheet?
One of our pages should have that for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we are going to hear some member projects.
This and it rolls onto the back.
There's nothing on the back. Representative DePell with House File 1192. And then Representative DePell, please state your name for the record, and testifiers, if you have them, please state your name for the records. And Representative DePell, you may proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Franzen and members. My name is Representative Tom DePell, and I represent Cottage Grove, Hastings, Nininger, and Denmark Townships. And I'm here to speak on this bonding bill for funding for water treatment facilities. We know that water is the most fundamental thing to life. If we didn't have water, we wouldn't be alive. And if we have to drink polluted water, that puts our health in jeopardy. So being made up of 60 to 70% water and having this be my first priority legislatively, I can't emphasize enough how important this is. One other item that I wanted to mention too is my first priority wasn't to come to this committee and ask for bonding dollars. I have explored extensively other avenues of funding and continue to do so. And this really only funds a fraction of what Hastings needs. So Hastings leadership has worked extremely hard to secure funds from other sources as well. They've been extremely good stewards of that money. And so I want to emphasize, even though there's $45.7 million more needed to complete this project, the 16.6 would at least get them on the way and be able to interconnect a veterans home also and other projects that are necessary for the health of Hastings. So I don't want to take up any more time, but I'd be happy to answer questions. I want to hand it over to Mayor Mary Franzen so she can talk on the subject.
For clarification.
Well,
Fassbender.
Right, yeah, Fassbender. Yes.
That would be, right.
We got a new mayor in town.
I had to look. I was like, oh, I don't know if I've met another Mary Franzen before. Spelt a little differently.
Yes.
But that's okay.
Yes.
Go.
Just as lovely, though.
But the first name is beautiful.
It is yes. Gorgeous. I love that name. Ms. Fassbender, you may proceed.
Chair Franzen and committee, I appreciate your time today. As this chair seems a little familiar because I was here a year ago requesting for the same dollars for our city. As Representative Dipple had said, we are asking for $16.6 million. Keeping that in mind, we have three treatment plants that we will need to make safe water drinkable and safe in our community. So one of three, this would help fund raise one of three. We do know, I want you to know that we are ranked number two for the project in the state on the project priority list, which creates more, we feel, devastation to our residents drinking this water. Our state veterans home, as Representative DePell had stated, is connected, and they have PFAS in our water, and they are not connected to city water, but they have PFAS in their water and would like to be connected to our city wells as well. We all love our veterans, and they deserve to have safe drinking water too. It would be a higher expenditure for them to add on to their own treatment plant than to just connect with ours. We are shovel ready, which is very important in this case. Many people have PFAS in their communities, and we have been working diligently and hard and reaching out to those funding sources that could help us. With that, we are still
in dire need. It's a budget buster, as many people know. The hardship of it is the health impacts to our community. We are striving to create housing for new families and younger families. We feel it's important for our businesses to be able to have safe drinking water. We're a growing community, and we feel it is our number one priority, and it is vital for our communities to sustain for safe drinking water. The hardship is when we get phone calls, and I get numerous of them, as many of my council members do, and our public works directors and their engineers. As we get a lot of news media, which is wonderful, it's making people more aware, we get more phone calls then. So it ebb and flows. It comes down, and then we get more phone calls. And those phone calls are hard to handle. We have pregnant mothers that call and say, can I drink this water? I have a handicapped child. Should he be drinking this water? We're not medical physicians, so we ask them to go to their doctors and find out. We need help to help this community so we don't have the fear in them. I go to the grocery store, and I'm in the water aisle, and are you drinking bottled water because it's unsafe? No, I'm picking up distilled water for my iron. But it's conversations like that, and then the conversation continues. Is it safe to drink our water? Do you drink the water? Yes, I do drink the water. But I also have a filtration system where that brings in financial burdens for a lot of our younger families as well. At the end of the day, like I said, we know that there are many communities that have PFAS in their water. We have it in all six of our wells. So we need urgency of funding as soon as we can. And without outside funding, this is going to be a major burden for our residents. $68.9 million is our total need, plus $1 million each year for operations and maintenance. Residents' water, we raised their rates 10% in January. We will do another 10% in July. Moving forward, our rates will increase over the next 4 years. To give you a little number, it's $80, from $80 to $205 within the next 4 years. That's hardship for a lot of our people in our community. I think about our senior citizens who are on fixed incomes. You know, we do live in a senior aging community, and I feel terrible for them because we don't have any answers.
Chair Franzen, may I make a comment?
Yes, Representative DePell.
So if Hastings hadn't received any funding, whether through grants or other means, water bills would have risen over 400%. And now the funding has come down to, unfortunately, still more than 50% needed. So if you cut that number in half, you're still looking at about over a 200% water bill increase, which, again, to the point of Mayor Fassbender, that would be a hardship to raise funds to that degree. So this technically is like an emergency within a municipality. This has been mandated for Hastings to build. The money didn't come with the mandate, and we have to make sure that the water is safe for our residents to drink.
Okay. Thank you. Members, did any of you have any questions? Representative Hansen. Oh, since you're going to go, Representative Hansen. Members, we did try to get the AG's office in here for a presentation on the 3M settlement, and my CA CA Joe Marble was unable to have any luck with that meeting. Personally, Representative Hansen, I hope that it's in lead. I hope it's not because Republicans right now are chairing this committee, and that's why the AG's office isn't here. It is very important that we do have them here, and I want to thank you, Representative Hansen, for yourself reaching out to the AG's office. I don't know if you had anything else to add on that topic.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you know, Representative Lee can follow up as well, that we will work with the AG's office to try to get them here whenever we can, because I think it's important to hear the 3M settlement and the communities that opted in, and then which ones have opted out, and that was going to be my question for the testifiers. But just, I know Representative Lee would like to comment as well.
Okay, Lee Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for giving me a call last night just to talk about that. And after that, the AG's office did reach out to me to communicate that, you know, it is their wish to come by and present to us. It's just that because of the scheduling, they couldn't make it within a short week notice. And so they are planning to be ready for us when we do want to call them back again. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I think that's why we work so well together on this on this committee, that we can go to one another and call in, phone a friend, call an assist, whatever it may be. So I am thankful for this committee and the members on it. And then Representative Hansen, you had a member to, or a question to ask.
Yes. So did Hastings opt into the national class action litigation? And if so, did how much money was received?
No, Hastings did not opt into that.
Representative DePell.
Thank you, Chair Franzen. Hastings did not opt into that, and Hastings has received funding for one well under that settlement. So TFSI is a particular chemical compound that was manufactured at the Chemolite plant, which is 3 miles north of Hastings, upriver from Hastings on the Mississippi. And it was found that that particular chemical was able to make its way into the groundwater. A direct connection was made, and the money was released from that settlement fund for Hastings.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe Representative Lee can follow up, as it was his bill. But, you know, we've tried two reports from MPCA of looking at a polluter pays model. Yes, we have the settlement, but this isn't some natural magical compound that just appeared. This was created by human beings and is now, frankly, in all of us,
poisoning
and
us.
Around the whole planet. Mm-hmm. And so a polluter pays model means that the people responsible help with the cleanup. And so I'll just say for the record, South St. Paul, well number 4, 39% hot. It provides a lot of the water for the city, 6.6 million just for South St. Paul. We can go to Woodbury, Oak Park Heights, all of these. And the settlement, as some of us said at the time, will not be enough, the state settlement. So we have the state settlement, we have the national class action, we have another national class action, and then independent actions. But to Representative Lee, if I hand off.
Lee Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, like Chair Hansen said, you know, it's a bill for us to consider, and I'm hopeful that, you know, we could work together, whether that's that bill or looking at other avenues to find funding for this critical issue. And I think, you know, just for all of our members too, you know, we heard from Lake Superior College that there's PFAS on the campus because of their firefighter training schools and whatnot. And so I think that this is an issue that's just larger. And I, you know, really appreciate the communities that are in front of us today. But, you know, we are going to hear more and more of these, you know, across, you know, whether that's our local communities or even some of our state agencies, you know, our schools and whatnot too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation, Representative DePell. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair.
Members, we are just doing informational only hearings as we then decide what's going to be in a bonding bill, if there is a bonding bill, all that good stuff. So thank you. All right, next up we have Representative Van Binsbergen. Please make your way to the front along with your testifiers. You may proceed by stating your name for the record and then continue with your testimony. I also like to welcome to the committee former state representative and lead of capital investment, Dean Erdahl. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Scott Van Binsbergen. I am from Montevideo, and I represent District 16A. It's in western Minnesota. It's all of Chippewa, Renville, and half of Meeker and part of Kandiyohi County. Thank you, members, for hearing House File 919.
Oh, and one second. Sorry, Representative. Members, the bills, we kind of forgot them at the cap of the Centennial Office Building, and due to the distance, it didn't make much sense to run back to get them. So they are online if you have questions. Okay, sorry about that. Continue, Representative Vanspin.
Thank you, Chair. Funding sought by my bill would go to help a community in my district, Litchfield, Minnesota. But it also goes to help a private enterprise, a dairy processing cooperative, First District. First District employs hundreds of people across the region, and it also affects hundreds of farm families. This bill would authorize a grant for $10 million to the Public Facilities Authority for First District. Because GO bond funding and financing is no longer a viable option, this is a cash ask. There's also a companion bill that I'm not bringing forward today, and that's to the city of Litchfield, and that is GO financing, and that's for $3.75 million. Because of regulatory compliances by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the most viable option is to allow the city of Litchfield in a dairy processing plant to come into compliance for First District. First District is a private enterprise, a dairy cooperative. The plan is to construct a pretreatment wastewater facility on city-owned land and next to the public treatment facility plant. The dairy economy, including milk producing out of First District, is a huge driver to the economy in central Minnesota and across this entire state. To give you a little context of the scope of what happens at First District, every Dorito that's made in the world is coated with cheese from First District. I want to turn things over to CEO of First District, Bob Hoffman. He's going to explain this in more detail. Bob?
Mr. Hoffman, please state your name for the record, and then you may proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Bob Hoffman. I'm the CEO of First District. We're a cooperative based in Litchfield, Minnesota. Pleased to be here to explain why House File 919 and the requesting grant funding to our cooperative through the PFA is critically necessary, not just to the wastewater treatment plant operated in the city of Litchfield and to maintaining the Clean Water Act and pollution standards, but to the entire dairy industry, specifically the dairy farmers across 40 counties in Minnesota that ship their milk to us every day, 365 days a year. That's approximately about 8.5 million pounds of milk a day that comes through our farmers across the 40 counties. We at First District are greatly appreciative for Representative Binsbergen, as well as taking the baton from former Representative Dean Erdahl on bringing House File 919 to the committee today. I can't thank both of them enough. Two things that I would like to tell you guys as quickly as I can. First, a little bit about the history of First District, and second, what the wastewater pretreatment system we are seeking funding for would do and why the funding from your committee is so important to our plant and the state's dairy industry and our dairy farmers in Minnesota. First District Association of Minnesota is we're the largest milk processing plant in the state. We make approximately 800,000 pounds of cheese per day and roughly 100 million pounds of powder that we export, roughly 50% of that in the global markets every year, primarily into infant formula products, bakery, and nutritional needs. Domestically, you can find our farmers' milk in these products through cheese, protein, or lactose, and products in every store, such as mac and cheese, Doritos, Johnsonville Brats, infant formula, Mars candies. It goes on and on. You can pretty much find in every store in our state where there's ingredients out of Litchfield, out of our plant that goes in it. First District is 104 years old, has a unique history of how we were formed by farmer communities coming together to leverage. We represent 40% of the milk in the state of Minnesota through our farmers, and we're a cooperative, which means we're not a private or publicly funded company or margin-producing company. We basically take all of our farmers or patrons' milk together. We pull that, and that can return a value back to the mailbox that can compete with our neighboring states and other regions that can process off of factory-type farms by being a cooperative and leveraging the pull together that helps make our farmers competitive and stay in business. Behind me, I actually have two dairy farmers that are leaders of First District and leaders in the state and at the industry. Paul Swenson, I'll have his hand up. Some of you guys may have served with his father, Howard Swenson, in the past. And then Joe Becker is from Eden Valley. Paul is from the Nicollet area. Both their family is running the farms, not only from prior generations, but from generations that are coming, and proud to have them here representing as well. We're just under 600 family members that own First District, ranging from 30 cows per farm up to roughly 2,000 to 3,000 cows per farm. That represents about 95% of the milk coming into First District. Our average farm size is in that 300 cow range. And again, we spread across 40 counties. We process 7.5 million pounds of milk a day into the plant, that we're producing about 800,000 pounds of cheese out of it. And again, this is 40% of the milk through the state that this is representing. If we have a problem at the plant, like I'm going to tell you about, and we need to cut back production, that would result in roughly a 50% production cutback of milk if we have to derate the plant to meet the standards.
Sorry, Mr. Huffman, do you have any other presenters? Reason why is we're running out of time here for your presentation. So I want to make sure, sure you get all your information in.
Okay. Just me and all Representative right. Ensor. The second point I would like to make, is it okay if I continue?
Yes, Mr. Huffman.
This issue that we're bringing forward really started with an expansion that began roughly 10 years ago. Our cooperative was looking for a way to serve and remain competitive, knowing that we needed to expand primarily for infrastructure, food safety, and making sure that we could keep up with the standards and sustain long term and not have a facility that couldn't maintain. So 10 years ago, it started with wastewater treatment. Our farmers looked at the cost to make sure we were going to be able to handle our expansion. Our farmers have invested roughly $46 million into wastewater infrastructure prior to this in order to be ready. At the conclusion of our expansion, as we built, even with that investment, we find ourselves in a situation where the Litchfield Wastewater Public Treatment Plant cannot adequately handle our volume and effluent with that expansion. While at first, last year, facing the risk of needing to shut down our plant or impose a partial shutdown, we've recently concluded a phase of negotiations with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and have adopted a schedule of compliance which necessitates us to construct a pretreatment system to treat the wastewater before it enters the public treatment plant. The City of Litchfield was offering a different public treatment infrastructure update, but that plan would have cost twice as much and not been able to meet the schedule, allowing us to comply with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and continue operating the plant. So we had to make a difficult choice to commit roughly $50 million to a pretreatment wastewater system to meet that compliance and to break ground on a new project in order to stay in compliance with the MPCA requirements and being able to continue receiving and processing our farmers' milk. Unfortunately, our cows, they don't have like a off switch. The milk keeps coming. So the problem is we don't have the equity or the borrowing capacity to complete the project on top of the $46 million that our farmers already invested to be able to handle this, and that's put us in a position we're in. And so the reason why I'm here before you today is, first, we are in need of financial assistance to complete the pretreatment project to keep operating the and meet the MPCA regulations. And secondly, we had to proceed with the project ourselves rather than the City of Litchfield's proposal, which rules out the option of general obligation bond financing because it's our project and we would be owned and maintained by us through a partnership being on the city's property and next to the city's wastewater treatment plant. I apologize.
Thank you. We have to be respectful to the other people that have bills up before us too, and we don't want to be able to come back late tonight to finish up. So, but I do want to say thank you for presenting. I do have a member question from Representative Ryer, and just know that we are very well aware of the situation in Litchfield. Representative Binsbergen has been very clear on where he stands, that where this priority is for him, as well as former Representative Dean Erdahl. He tried super hard to get this across the finish line last year, and he's passionate about getting it done this year, along with the representative. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I'm just curious, a couple of times in your presentation you made a point that this was for a private company, and I'm just curious if we have a precedent of funding private companies and, you know, what your thought is on that. Thanks.
Well, First District is a co-op.
Binsbergen. We practiced this last night, pronouncing your last name, but continue on.
Sorry, Madam Chair. First District is a co-op, so it is a little bit different. And clearly there is a huge need. The Minnesota Pollution and Control Agency is causing great concern with the potential of huge fines going to be levied against the company. And, we're asking for a different type of financing. The money's not going to go directly to First District. It's going to go to the Minnesota Facilities Authority and a grant to First District. So, we're asking for a cash for $10 million.
Representative Erdahl, would you like to address this? Come up front. Yeah. And then if you could just, I'm sorry to rush you, but definitely take your time getting up there, though. Continue on. Please state your name for the record, and if you can answer Representative Ryer's question real quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dean Erdahl. And the answer to your question is yes. State money has been given to private organizations, and Representative Van Binsbergen clarified a little bit that, this is a co-op, but there has been money before given to First District in this identical situation. There's $5 million in a bill a couple of years ago. There are also a couple of other examples that I actually forget, but I can tell you of other private organizations that have been given funding from the state, so this is not a first-time thing here. Also, indirectly, where we have BDPI and things like that, where the state gives money through capital investment to private individuals and companies. Thank you.
Representative Ryer, does that help you? I knew he would have the historical knowledge on that. Thank you. Leadley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to correct my good friend, Representative Erdahl, but programs like IBDPI, GBPDI, these are for our public entities to create the infrastructure to bring in these private entities, and so these are still publicly owned infrastructure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Leadley. All right.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Lee. That's certainly true, but again, I can cite examples that I have in a folder that I don't have with me right now where we have given money directly to private companies.
Mr. Erdahl, Representative Erdahl, if you would not mind just emailing the committee members that information when you have a hot second, that'd be great. Right. Thank you. All right. Do we have any further questions for Representative Van Binsbergen?
Madam Chair, just would like to offer, if there's any members that want to visit more about this, please reach out to me. I would love to visit more about what we're trying to accomplish.
That sounds great. We look forward to those conversations. Thank you. Thank you for presenting in front of us. You're now free. All right. We have Representative Hill is up with two bills today. Yeah, we have House File 212 and House File 214. Big day for Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Franson and Lead Lee and members. Hey, I'll be brief.
Please state your name for the record.
Representative Josiah Hill, representing District 33B. With me today is Mayor Ted Klazowski and City Administrator Joe Coleman.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Franson and members. We live in the East Metro out in Stillwater, and this is an appropriation that we are seeking for PFAS mitigation in our wells. A couple of things. As you know, out in the East Metro, we have in our backyard the global lead producer of PFAS. And it should come as no surprise that these chemicals are now being found in our wells in Stillwater and surrounding communities. In a few moments, you're going to hear from our neighbors in Oak Park Heights. A couple of things that I want to offer. Stillwater was not able to access the funds that were set aside in the 3M settlement. And as we look to mitigate these problems for our residents to make sure that they have safe drinking water here in, over in Stillwater, there's a couple of unique challenges that that we're facing in Stillwater. I'll close with a few comments, but I do want to turn it over to Mayor Ted Klazowski.
All right.
Mayor Klazowski.
Good morning, Chair Franson and members of the House Capital Investment Committee. I'm Ted Kozlowski, the mayor of Stillwater. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be here today. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for the chance to speak with this committee. I also want to thank Representative Hill for advocating for House File 212. I also want to say I didn't think I could be any more proud to be a Minnesotan until I heard that there's a little Minnesota cheese dust on every Dorito in the world. I thought that was a great thank you for the fun fact today. But I'm here today to request consideration of a state bonding to help the citizens and businesses of Stillwater due to the newly discovered existence of PFAS in our water supply. We now need a new water treatment plant up and running and simply don't have the resources to do this alone. It's a very similar scenario to what the mayor, my colleague in Hastings, presented. The numbers are very similar. We're a little bit smaller than the city of Hastings. We're just about 19,000 residents. We have 8 wells. 6 of them are impacted. We're a small city with an epically huge problem that we just really cannot solve on our own. We just don't have the capacity. We have about 100 employees in the city of Stillwater. We have 3 people in our water department, and we're facing a pretty epic challenge with these wells. As many of you know, we're a regional destination. We welcome visitors from all over the state and the country. I hope many of you have had the opportunity to come visit us at some point. And like Hastings and many of the other communities that are impacted, we have to make sure that our community has access to clean, safe water. I get many of the same phone calls and concerned parents and people in our community that the mayor of Hastings is experiencing. What she said is more or less the exact same experience that we're having here in Stillwater. We know also this is a large number. We're happy to work with the investment committee to phase this project if necessary and anything we can do. We understand the need for a local contribution from our community. We're willing to do that, of course, and we recognize you're all working with budget difficulties as well. But I really hope that we can come together to find a way to get this project going for us and for our other communities, our friends and neighbors. You're going to hear from our friends across the way in Oak Park Heights. Our friends down the river in Hastings spoke well about this project. I think everybody understands what the problem is. And so, again, just thank you so much for taking the time to hear our request. And I've got our city administrator, Joel Coleman. I'm going to let him fill you in with on some of the details here really quickly.
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much for having us. Just to kind of expand on the scope and perspective of the magnitude of this issue for the city of Stillwater. So we have 6 impacted wells, as the mayor had stated. 3 of them are at or near the maximum contaminant levels for the federal government. We're getting estimates of about $10 million per well to treat. I understand that we're proposing to treat three wells, and we have the total request of $40 million in front of you, but there's some underground water main work that has to be done to potentially connect the wells and kind of centralize some of the treatment that goes on. So just for some perspective on that, when we were doing some financial planning a couple of years ago, I asked our financial planner, what's the maximum amount the city of Stillwater could borrow? Because I was more or less just curious, and she said about $80 million. So we keep about $30 million of debt rolling on the books for fire trucks and police cars and road improvements and building improvements. So the idea or thought of adding $40 million onto our existing $30 million rolling debt, I mean, puts future borrowing in jeopardy for the city of Stillwater, for our public safety equipment, and you could just imagine what that could potentially do to some type of bond rating that the city would receive. So the city going at this initiative alone is really just almost even a non-starter. There's not really even a pathway to get there for the city to do it on its own. We're not a growing community like some of our other friends that have PFAS, where they're adding new water users, and those users are paying water connection fees, and they're able to finance some of these loans with that growth and development. So the city of Stillwater is certainly in a unique spot with a very difficult challenge in front of them.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Members, do we have any questions? It's phasing capabilities. Have you thought about any of that? Because our bonding bill isn't going to be that great of a size if we get one done.
Madam Chair, this is the way it's set up. We have been working on designing some plans going forward. It could be easily phased in where you treat one or two wells, some of the higher producing wells that the city has online. So any help that the city would be able to get, we could certainly contribute towards this project and make headway on it for sure.
Thank you. And Representative Hill, I'd encourage you to keep in contact with Lead Lee on your projects as well as myself too, okay? Thank you. Did you want to continue on?
No, thank you, Chair Franson. Just in closing, Representative DePell, will continue to seek out any and all partnerships. Been in touch with Representative McCollum and her work on the federal level. Unfortunately, at this moment in history, not certain there's a lot of help coming from the federal government. And so looking for any and all support here locally and at the state level, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representatives.
Thank you. Thank you. Yep. And then you've got one more, House File 214.
Thank you, Chair Franson. And I'll get underway while our friends are taking their seat. With me today, I have Council Member from Oak Park Heights, Mike Lil Gren, excuse me. I've been working on that one, too. And Jake Reif, our City Administrator at Oak Park Heights.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yes, indeed. And Representatives, very similar concern, but in a little bit of a different phase of the project. And so I'll turn over in a moment to our Oak Park Heights residents to share more about the unique elements that they're facing. But I want to point out that Oak Park Heights is a community that for generations has hosted a coal generation plant to serve the region, and we continue to do that work today. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Reif.
Mr. Reif, if you want to please state your name for the record and proceed, unless the other gentleman would like to go instead.
Madam Chair, I'm actually passing it over to Councilmember Liljegren.
Okay. Councilmember, if you want to state your name for the record and proceed.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Mike, I can't even talk.
You joined the club and not pronouncing your own name. I love it.
Mike Liljegren, Oak Park Heights City Council member. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today. Madam Chair, thank you for hearing this bill, and I'd also like to thank Representative Hill for authoring the bill and his strong advocacy for the community of Oak Park Heights. Oak Park Heights is a small city, less than 5,000 residents, located in the St. Croix River Valley. Our residents, businesses, and visitors rely on our city infrastructure. Unfortunately, PFAS has been detected in our municipal water supply, and now we must build a water treatment plant to address this problem. As you can imagine, that this is extremely difficult and financial burden for the city of our size. We are respectfully requesting $1.55 million in a bonding request to assist in the design and engineering costs of this project. We are doing all we can to pursue fundings for this opportunity, and we have secured a grant for a feasibility study and pre-design work, and now we're asking for your help in those next step. Thank you.
Right. Mr. Reif, did you have something to add?
Madam Chair, I had nothing to add. Okay. We're certainly here for any questions that you or the committee has.
Great. Members? Questions? Representative Hansen? Nothing? Okay. Representative Ryer? No? All right. My frequent flyers are not participating. Well, I didn't want to go to my side of the aisle yet. Okay, Representative Perez Vega. All right.
Question. I'll run it. Right. Thank you, madam. I want to ask in particular, because we have the DOC here this week, and Oak Park's state prison is there, and I have received numerous emails regarding their water conditions, and the DOC says that it's okay, and I'm a little concerned because I don't think it's okay when I've seen levels of the waters of samples that were brought, or pictures, so to say, and how that connects with Oak Park, being that it's in the same city, same community. You know, is it a way that if we support this project or that project of the DOC's request, how that would support the levels of the PFAs, you know, the work that you're trying to do here presented in the bill? Is that kind of like a circulation of the water system in Oak Park?
And who would like to take that question?
Madam Chair and Representative, we'd have to look into that. Yeah, and certainly we'd get back to you with that information.
Thank you.
Representative, okay. Thank you. All right, moving on to this side. Any questions? Okay. Well, I want to thank you for presenting today, Representative Hill. Thank you, Council Member, and Mr. Reif, I didn't want to screw up your last name. But thank you for your time and making your way down to the Capitol. Appreciate it. Testimony, you know, was very useful, and just stay in touch. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair France.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Oops, I guess we have to adjourn. I was just going to walk away. All right. Well, if there's no other business before the committee, I don't have anything. Does anyone else have to add? Representative Hansen has some extra treats if you would like to grab one. Thank you for picking those up today, Representative Hansen. I hope you have a very good birthday starting Saturday. I don't know about him, but I celebrate all month long. So that'll be fun. Thank you. All right. Well, members, considering there's nothing else before us, I will adjourn the meeting, and we will see you next week.